December 2024, when everyone thought the Arab Spring had ended in Syria, in literally just 1 week, the regime collapsed. There is now a new regime in Syria. World leaders scrambled to meet this new regime, demanding an inclusive government and rights to minorities. Ahmed al-Sharaa, formerly known as Abu Muhammad Jolani, he's got a task ahead of him, with Syria being battered by civil war and now Israel seizing territory. What does the future hold for Syria, and how do we unpack this? Before we go over to our guest today, I would like to remind everyone that Geopolity is on all social media platforms. Please subscribe so you don't miss a thing. In addition to that, we have a deep dive on the geopolitics of Syria, so be sure to check it out. I'd like to introduce my guest, our founder, Adnan Khan. How are you keeping, Adnan?
I'm good, Yusuf. How are you keeping as well?
I'm not too bad. I think Syria is a very complicated situation. Could you just briefly outline Syria's historical importance in the Middle East? It's slap bang in the middle.
Yes, that's what makes Syria important, Yusuf. That's what's attracted many powers in ancient history, and it's what attracts all the powers today. It's right in the middle of the Middle East. It shares a border with Turkey. It shares a border with Iraq, has a border with Jordan, and it has a border with Lebanon and Israel as well. So whoever controls or influences Syria actually has access to the broader region. And that's what's attracted the British in the past. It attracted the French. It attracted the Soviet Union. And it attracts America as well. And that's why in many ways, the Syrian people's lives and Syria as a nation, it's been determined a lot by outside powers. And that's why what's happened now with the overthrow of the long-term regime, it has a lot of implications, which I'm sure we're going to unpick today.
Now, the Arab Spring, specifically in Syria, started in 2011, a long time ago now. Could you briefly go into that? How did this evolve into a full-scale war?
So, absolutely. The uprising in Syria, the Arab Spring in Syria, was part of the broad Arab Spring, which began in Tunisia. It quickly shifted to Egypt, then it went to Libya, then it came to Syria, and it went to a whole host of other countries. And the common theme being wars is the people felt the countries ruled didn't represent them. The economic situation was really bad. And a lot of countries involved in the Arab Spring, these were countries where the rulers or the military dictatorship, they ruled with an iron fist. So you saw after a long period of time, a lot of oppression. Many took to the streets to overthrow the regime. So we saw Ben Ali overthrown in Tunisia. We saw Hosni Mubarak overthrown in Egypt. We saw Ali Abdel Saleh in Yemen eventually overthrown. And we saw a similar thing take place in Syria, although it went on for over a decade. So yes, the uprising in Syria and what we've seen for the last few weeks and months, it was part of the broader Arab Spring, which is people trying to take back their destiny. People wanting to live a decent life. They want decent economic prospects and they don't want to live in fear. I'm sure many have seen the images and the videos that came out from the prisons or other stories are still coming out as well. Nobody wants to live like that. And I'm sure at the start of 2025, Bashar probably fought in 2024. He survived the Arab Spring and he's going to be the dictator for life. That obviously didn't happen. But the oppressed people, eventually people will arise up. So what really took place in Syria was part of the broader Arab Spring uprisings.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that because, a lot of the other dictators were removed fairly quickly. If we actually think about it, Mubarak, Ben Ali, within a few years they were removed. But Bashar al-Assad, he managed to hold power for an incredibly long amount of time even after that. How did he manage to do this?
So he did that because he received a lot of external support. So we saw Iran get involved very quickly. We saw his Revolutionary Guards get involved. We saw Hezbollah get involved. We saw the intervention of Russia eventually. On the flip side, you saw a lot of the regional countries get involved. You saw Turkey, you saw Jordan, you saw the UAE, you saw Saudi Arabia, and even America as well. So it took effectively the global powers and the regional powers to get involved to make sure real change doesn't come to this country. And that's why he was able to last so long, 13, 14 years from when the uprising started. the Syria uprising was very unique, Yusuf, from the perspective that the people were very clear compared to the other countries that they want the regime gone and they want to replace it with something that represents them, their sentiments, their feelings, i.e. Islam. And this was very clear from the symbols, from the slogans, from what they were calling for. That's what made Syria very unique. And that's why I think you saw the world's powers really get involved, because this was not a place you could have real change in. This, it would unravel the whole region. So if you look at Egypt, if you look at the other countries, you saw the West back some factions. You saw them deal with it very differently compared to Syria. So Syria was very unique from that perspective.
Yeah, the perception, when I look back, the perception was at the time that you had on one side, you've got the US, Turkey, Saudi was there, UAE, Jordan, even Israel was there. So they were kind of on one camp. And then on the other side, the side that was trying to protect the regime, you had the likes of Iran, Hezbollah, and Russia. Is that really a true assessment of what was happening at the time?
So like all crisis, Yusuf, they are opportunities. And the image that was presented was on one side, you had Iran, you had Hezbollah, you had Russia. These were countries trying to prop up the Syrian regime. There were relations that go back decades. Then on the flip side, you had America, you had the European countries, you had Turkey, you had Jordan, you had the UAE. And these were countries that were backing the rebel groups who were trying to overthrow the regime. So the image the West tried to present is we are supporting the people in their legitimate uprising against the leader. And therefore, you know, we're arming them, we're funding them. And then also ISIS emerged from nowhere. Therefore, what happens there is really important. So we need to get involved, because ISIS will eventually end up in the Western countries, which it did. In the end. So that was the image that was presented. However, what you find, Yusuf, is lots of evidence that the resources the groups needed, the weapons the groups needed, was never provided. And in fact, what you find is one by one, each of the different factions that was backed by different countries, they were pushed to join talks in different countries. These talks included regime officials as well. So you're fighting them in your country, and now you're sitting down with them in another country. And eventually these talks became the official channel through which negotiations and the future of the country would be decided. So what you find is eventually they stop fighting in Syria and they join the talks. So the fighting effectively stopped, or it was just left to a few groups in the end. So it really begs the question, were the West actually backing these groups to make sure they defeat the regime? Or were they actually backing them in order to get control over them and take them in a very different direction? And this is something Zelensky of Ukraine is learning the really, really hard way. In Syria, a lot of this was concealed. Now America's been very open. We're not going to back Ukraine. You want to fight Russia, you fight on your own. And many people are like, hold on. So all this time, you could have armed us. You could have given us more. It could have made a difference. Really, this was your agenda from the beginning. So what's going on in Ukraine now is the exact model the Western countries used in Syria. The only difference in Syria was there was many different rebel groups, and the assumption was these different groups, some are good, some are bad, and the West are trying to work with some against the other. Obviously, in Ukraine, you've only got one Ukrainian people, and the West is backing them. So, you know, your question is important because it assumes there were two sides. And we can discuss this. There weren't two sides. There was one side, which is real change should have come to this country. What became very complex, though, was how would you get there? How would you maintain the regime? So what you found was there were countries who said, we're backing the people, we're backing them against the regime, but they never provided the resources, the weapons, the heavy weapons that would actually make a difference.
There's a lot there. I just want to try to kind of break that down. So you mentioned some of the parties or some of the groups you had. These are the ones that are actually within the country. So you had the likes of the Kurdish fighters, the different rebel groups, obviously the regime itself, and then ISIS. So let's try to break down each one of these parties. What were ISIS doing there? Because obviously they weren't from within the country. They came in afterwards.
So what ISIS did is really, really murky. ISIS origins are even more murkier. And now it's becoming more and more clear. Where have you ever seen a picture of ISIS, a video of ISIS? All the damage they caused, their convoys are going across borders, American intelligence is in the region. Where are the images? Where are the videos? You don't see any of it. But you've heard a lot. ISIS is this group that wants to take over the world. In fact, every time ISIS took over an area, they'd commit a massacre and it'll be on YouTube faster than anybody could actually think. So what happened was when the Arab Spring started in 2011 and then Syria quickly kicked off, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, who fought the American occupation, they sent Abu Muhammad al-Julani to effectively go and join the uprising in Syria. So all the leaders of ISIS were in Camp Bakr, which was an American base in the south of Baghdad. And there's a lot of question marks that how come all the ISIS leadership were in the same prison? America knows who these guys are. They're in your prison. They're let out one by one and they go on to form ISIS. So this is the murky question that everyone has. Then something interesting happened. Baghdadi, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS, he announced all of a sudden that we're merging Al-Qaeda in Iraq and Jabhat al-Nusra in Syria, the group he sent over there. So the leaders of Jabhat al-Nusra were Muhammad Julani, Ahmed al-Sharra, as we know now. But a bit of, there was a falling out. Ahmed al-Sharra was like, no, we're a separate group. And then he managed to reach out to the leader of Al-Qaeda, Ayman Zawahiri, and swore loyalty to him. Meaning, I'm not loyal to Baghdadi, I'm loyal to the leader of Al-Qaeda. So that led to tension between Al-Qaeda in Syria and Al-Qaeda in Iraq, ISIS. So what the ISIS guys eventually did was they went from Iraq into Syria and they started taking over the Kurdish areas. They got to Aleppo and then in Raqqa, which is on the east of Syria, they announced this was the capital of our caliphate. Now, the timing is really important here. ISIS did this around 2013. The uprising in Syria started in 2011. And because of the massive defections in the Syrian army, what the Syrian army realized and what the regime realized was they can't fight across the whole country. They've lost too many troops. So they've given up taking over the north of the country. So I remember Bashar al-Assad actually gave a speech to the Syrian people where he said, we still need to win the country back, but because of the lack of resources, we have to focus on Damascus. What that meant was the rebels are about to launch an assault on Damascus. I have lost the rest of the country. This was a circumstance when ISIS came into Syria. So they didn't go to Damascus to fight the regime. They went to the north, to the areas already captured by the rebel groups. So unfortunately, what it did, it crippled the rebel groups who had to turn back and go and fight ISIS. And that's why till today, there are statistics. So Jane's Intelligence actually did a one-year profile of attacks in Syria. And they found around 2013-14, a whole one-year period, most of the attacks by the regime and ISIS were not on each other. They were actually on the other rebel groups. So that is a level of coordination, knowingly or unknowingly. So ISIS did not help the uprising. ISIS did not support the rebel groups. They did action that actually served the regime. And in fact, if ISIS didn't come about, the regime probably would have fallen.
You said ISIS first attacks the Kurds, but weren't the Kurds backed by the US? Why would US let ISIS overpower them?
So the American support for the Kurds came after ISIS came into Syria. It wasn't actually there beforehand. In fact, the only Kurds we really know about, Yusuf, are the Kurds in Iraq. Nobody really knew about the Kurds in the north of Syria before the Arab Spring uprising. The Turks know about them because they're linked to the Kurdish groups in Turkey. Nobody really knew a lot about, I mean, they're a minority. There wasn't really many of them. We know about the Kurds in the north of Iraq. So when they came in, they took over the Kurdish areas, and that was when America intervened to help the Kurds. However, and this is a question I have to today, ISIS were crisscrossing actually, the Syria-Iraq border on a daily, weekly basis on their trucks. They had convoys, they had weapons and material. Not once did America carry out a strike to stop them. And that begs the question that they were serving America's agenda at the time, which was what? Which was to make sure the regime doesn't fall, which was to make sure the rebel groups don't succeed. Once ISIS had achieved that, well, then America's position changed on them. which sound very similar to what's happening in Ukraine at the moment.
So let's go into some of the rebel groups. You mentioned that there was numerous different factions. The one that you mentioned just recently was Jabhat al-Nusra under Jolani. Can you tell us a bit more about the different groups, the major players in the area at the time?
So when the uprising started, you saw peripheral groups emerge who named them sort of after Sahabas, the Khalid bin Walid Brigade, the Abu Bakr Siddiq Brigade, the Umar bin Khattab Brigade. There were many. Obviously, what happened as the uprising and the civil war went on longer, you have to organize, you have to coordinate. So the number of groups started to shrink because they amalgamated. And then also because different factions were backed by different countries, those countries had their own agenda. So in the end, really, what you had left was Jabhat al-Nusra, who was one of the most capable. You had Arar al-Sham, which was actually a coalition of 12 groups at one stage, which then eventually joined Jabhat al-Nusra anyway in the north of the country. You obviously had the Kurds as well. You had a number of groups in the south of Syria as well. We don't really hear much about them. And the reason why, when Bashar al-Assad and his forces took back the country, the rebel groups then fell back to the north of Syria. So the general landscape was, you got the whole south of the country under regime control, you had the Kurds, and then you had the northwest of the country, which is where these rebel groups were. And so they actually, Jabhat al-Nusra ruled over these areas. They carried out administration. You can find a YouTube documentary, I think the CNN actually interviewed Jolani in 2019. When he wasn't that well known at the time. During this period, some of these rebel groups fought each other. Arar al-Sham even fought against Jabhat al-Nusra. Jabhat al-Nusra won. And then they rebranded themselves as Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which is what we know them as now. When they rebranded, they actually said at that point that we've cut all ties with Al-Qaeda. We are a Syrian-based group. We are an administration in the north of Syria in Idlib. We now have no ties with Al-Qaeda in Iraq or Al-Qaeda globally as well. And this is something Ahmad al-Sharr said a million times today as well now, that you know we're not linked, we've completely rebranded. There's another interesting thing here. When ISIS was, when they lost their territory, once America stopped bombing them, they then started bombing Jabhat al-Nusra, right? And then now America's sitting down as with Jabhat al-Nusra and their leader. So literally in 13 years, America's bombed the people, sat down with them, and they might even bomb them in the future.
Yeah, I think it's a crazy set of events. Going back to this rebranding, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, was the main reason they wanted to rebrand just purely to show that they have separated from Al-Qaeda? Or was it an amalgamation of more rebel groups under that group name?
So you find, Yusuf, in 2025, there's a number of books coming out about HTS, about Ahmad al-Sharr. So these are journalists who have spent time in Idlib, spent time over the last 10 years. And what you do find is he's quite a smooth operator, Ahmad al-Sharr. He's picked the right side a few times, even at the time. He didn't even have the resources. So when he left Al-Qaeda in Iraq, that was quite a big move to play. You're from Iraq originally. You spent time there fighting against American forces. Now you're going to Syria and you're turning against your old boss. However, he succeeded in that. He was accepted by the other groups. And these guys were very capable. His guys, they'd been fighting in Iraq for about a decade. So they were insurgents. They had learned. What then happened was is he did the administration of Idlib. And you hear good stories, you hear bad stories as well. But what you do hear is someone who actually does understand what it means to rule. He understands that you need to be pragmatic. That is probably what makes it a bit more dangerous, what his plan is in the future, how independent he is as well. However, they dealt with dissent very ruthlessly. We're now finding out a lot of the wives of the rebel groups who disagreed with Jabhat al-Nusra. They were arrested. Their women actually carried out protests, carried out marches in Idlib. So, you know, he's quite a capable operator. He seems to know how to pick the sides and he seems to understand the politics of the country who's who. So that's probably why he's been able to navigate, you know, across the Syrian landscape, which probably indicates to you why the West and the regional nation have backed him.
We'll get on to Joe Lowney a little bit later. I just want to fast forward. So we've had this civil war, and it ended up being almost like a stalemate. In fact, it probably looked like Bashar al-Assad had won because the rebels, like you mentioned, they really just controlled parts of the north, Idlib in particular. Could you tell us what the landscape looked like at this time?
So Russia intervened in 2015 because after ISIS emerged, Damascus didn't fall. However, what Bashar found by 2015, his forces were exhausted, what was left of them, and Hezbollah had done what they can. The Shia militia that came in had done what they could, and he realized he's only got back about half the country. He didn't have the resources. That was when then Russia intervened. And, you know, I say here that the Russian intervention wasn't some independent intervention. America and Russia sat down. This was actually agreed. And it was agreed because this was exactly when Russia took over Crimea. It was around that time this had happened. But the more important thing is America and Russia agreed an air protocol because they both had air assets in Syria. They actually agreed an air protocol to make sure that there's no crashes and there's no misinformation. So they were communicating on the ground about their air assets. That is not what you do if you disagree with a country coming into your airspace. If Russia's the enemy and you're trying to overthrow the regime, you wouldn't make that sort of deal with the enemy, would you? But that's what America did. So where first ISIS emerged to save the regime and America didn't do anything, America sat down with Russia and actually agreed this. So what Russia did was it basically carried out air attacks and it gave air cover to the forces on the ground. The legwork was done by the Shia militia, the IRGC, and what remained of Bashar al-Assad's forces. So this was Iran managing the ground war, and Russia managed the air war. They carried out untold atrocities. You've seen the pictures, I'm sure, of what they've done to these towns. They literally are, you know, we're talking about suburbs of Damascus, they turn into rubble. 2016, Aleppo, the commercial hub in the north, that fell. That basically was the end of the uprising. Bashar's got back most of the country. However, Turkey at that point decided to take over the Kurdish areas. It wasn't too happy about America working with the Kurds and the Kurds getting very, very strong. So what you find from that point onwards, Turkey has effectively controlled the border area between Syria and Turkey. And that region remained out of regime hands. So from 2016 onwards, I think Bashar tried three or four times to carry out a major operation, a major assault to take back the whole of the country, including the north. But he found two problems. Firstly, Turkey was there. And then secondly, in the Idlib area, they were linked to and managed by Turkey as well. So this was a problem for Bashar. But what he's saying is, I am the legitimate leader of this country. I've taken over the whole country. So the world should really be dealing with me. The problem was to take back the north of the country, he needed a Russian air cover. And what Russia did is they didn't want to get into war with Turkey. So what they did, they sat down with Turkey and they came up with various agreements. They came out with de-escalation zones. They came out with ceasefires. And even Iran joined these talks. So by the time COVID came about, Bashar had a scenario that the countries that were helping him, Iran and Russia, they're sitting down with Turkey and trying to de-escalate things, whilst he wants to escalate things and take back the north of the country. So this was actually the scenario on the eve of what we saw at the end of 2024. Bashar had taken back the country. He physically hadn't got the north of the country. So you find, I think, by 2022, Yusuf, the Arab League had welcomed Bashar back. The EU was talking about lifting sanctions off Bashar because they want Syrian refugees to go back home and not come to Europe. And even there was talk in America that we need to remove the other sanctions against Bashar. So really, it was quite a big turnaround in 13 years. Bashar had gone from pariah, massacring his own people. And the reasoning from a lot of countries was, look, he's won. He's taken back the whole country. He is a legitimate leader. So we're just going to work pragmatically with what it is. And that was the scenario, really, by 2023.
So the million-dollar question then, Adnan, if everything was going in in Bashar al-Assad's favor, people were now accepting him back into the international community. Why have the US and the rest of the world actually taken a U-turn on this and accepted the fall of the Assad regime?
So everything was going well. You're right. The deep dive you mentioned in your intro, we actually go through the geopolitics of Syria. And in there, we actually go through that Syria actually has been very close to America since the time of Hafiz al-Assad, Bashar al-Assad's father. They've actually been a proxy for America in the region. And that's why it makes sense now why America intervened to try and save the regime. So what happened? What happened was the 7th of October changed everything. The Hamas assault on Israel, that changed everything. What changed? Well, Netanyahu said from day one, we are going to reshape the security balance in the region. What Netanyahu and Israel did after October 7th is they didn't just launch an attack on Hamas. Their plan was, we are completely going to alter the strategic security situation in the region. So what does that mean? What that means is Israel has always said that they're threatened by certain countries in the region, Egypt in the past, Jordan in the past, today's Iran. Their main threat is the armed groups. So you've got Hamas and then you've got Hezbollah. So you saw they started their attack on Gaza straight away. America said, don't start something in Lebanon. They did. Then they started doing attacks on Yemen and the sea area as well. And during the Arab Spring, Yusuf, Israel has always been attacking Syria, not the Syrian state. Israel, interestingly, Yusuf, had a very stable relationship with Bashar al-Assad and his family. In fact, Yusuf, the strongest, most stable border of Israel has always been the one with Syria. The al-Assads had accepted Israel taking the Golan Heights. As long as we stay in power, we're happy with that scenario. Israel only had one problem with Syria, and that was his relationship with Iran. Other than that, they're all on the same page. So the Hezbollah supply line goes from Iran through Iraq, through Syria into Lebanon. That has always been a problem for Israel. So what Israel did during the Arab Spring in Syria, it regularly carried out attacks in Syria against Hezbollah and against the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guards. It was regularly doing that. What you find, Yusuf, is when Hassan Nasrallah was killed in September and the Hezbollah leadership was taken out, that seems to be the point where the decision was made that the supply line has to be cut in that goes for Syria. And at that point, it seems that the division was made that the regime is going to change there, because if you're going to cut the supply line, the regime needs to go through it as well. And the evidence for this is the Telegraph actually did an article where the groups that were involved in the uprising in Syria, that were involved in overthrowing Bashar, they said that in early October, they were organized by the American base in the south of Syria with Iraq. And they were told, you need to get ready. We're going to start a major operation. So the timing was exactly after the collapse of Hezbollah. And that is what eventually turned into what we saw. They took over Aleppo, took over Hama, and then the regime fell.
So you mentioned the US, you mentioned Israel. What was Turkey doing at the time? Because obviously Turkey was one of the key backers of HTS.
So what Turkey's been doing is been heavily involved in Syria. Keep in mind that I think the northern part of Syria was part of Turkey in the past. So what Turkey's been doing is been managing that border, and it's been doing way more than that, actually. What it's been doing is been getting involved in organizing them. So Turkish intelligence is heavily involved in the north of Syria. It's been organizing the groups. It's been arming them. So really, Turkey was always going to be involved. You know, if Damascus was a fool, Turkey was always going to play a central role. Which begs the question, why did they do this 13 years ago? They could have, because HTS ruled in coordination with Turkey. The rebel groups that joined HTS to do this assault are all Turkish armed, controlled and managed. This was, the regime was overthrown fundamentally by Turkey. What were the excuses we heard for 13 years? What we heard was, Russia's here. We can't do this. It's too much of an effort. Turkey doesn't have those abilities. In those 13 years, Yusuf, Turkey's gone to war with Russia in Azerbaijan and in Libya. But in Syria, it can't do anything. In the 13 years, Turkey stayed in the northern areas, and then in 1 week, we saw a group that they've literally managed overthrow the regime. Now, obviously, over a 13-year period, the state's been gutted, the military's not even being paid, the economy's in shambles and under sanctions. So actually, if this assault was going to happen, the regime was always going to cripple. So although the regime seemed to have survived, any push by a sizable power, the outcome would have been the same. So Turkey did this because the timing for America had changed. Because Israel now wants to change the regional security, it managed to win over America to this idea, although for different reasons. And that's when the dominoes all got into line, which really shows you that Turkey is in bed, not with the Palestinians, not with the rebel groups, is actually more in bed with America and Israel when it comes to the region.
You mentioned that the Syrian-Israel border, it was the most secure border that Israel has. It's not had any problems in this region. If that was the case, why would Israel want the Assad regime to fall? Is it something which is in America's interest, but not necessarily within Israel's interest, and therefore are they walking in two different directions in regards to Syria?
No, so you find that since October 7th, there are many things America was against Israel doing, and Israel did them, and America joined them in the end. So America didn't want a full-scale invasion of Gaza. Eventually, it was scaled down, but for the Gaza people, it was still far worse. America said to Israel in the beginning not to open up a second front with Lebanon. They did. America told Israel not to launch strikes on Iran. They did, and America joined them and facilitated them. This is how America always deals with Israel. It's very different to other countries. Other countries would have been sanctioned over this. Remember, Israel is America's forward base in the region. When Israel disobeys America, America deals with it very, very differently. You've seen, since Trump's come to power, how he's dealing with Israel. He's putting his foot down. This is how we're doing it. That's not happened with the Biden administration. Remember what's happened in Syria. If you've replaced a Ba'athist secular dictator with an Islamist-looking, feeling, sounding leader, for America, which is the better option? Well, the Islamist looks, the people will have more affinity with him. So if you've just replaced one proxy ruler with another, well, for America, nothing changes there. They're just managing, they're managing Syria. And this is quite normal. I mean, if you look at it, I think in the Gaddafi was the longest standing in the region. The Assads were the next longest standing. I mean, if you take away the monarchies in the region. So to be honest with you, at some point this was junior. But now what you've got in Syria, you've got a scenario where America has someone they know. They've got their proxies in power. And Israel's also happy because the supply line's been cut. So although Bashar al-Assad protected the border, there was always a problem Israel had that they've got a close relationship Syria has with Iran. Now Israel's got both, which is we've taken over the Golan Heights, we've taken over parts of Syria, we've got a regime which is American-backed, and the supply line to Hezbollah has been cut. So now Israel's got everything it wants. Before, it had a secure border, but there was a supply line going through Syria to Hezbollah. That's been completely cut.
So HTS launched their attack, and literally the regime collapsed within a week or so. Why didn't the initial countries that were backing the regime, Iran and Russia, how come they didn't intervene? How come Bashar al-Assad's forces, yeah, they'd been fighting for this long, how come they just literally threw down their arms? Can you tell us about this?
So what effectively happened, Yusuf, is what happens in a coup. When a coup begins, the military has to decide which side they want to be on. And everybody wants to make sure they're on the side that wins. Not necessarily the right side, the side that wins. So the coup plotters, they need to create an image. They need to create facts on the ground that show our coup is about to succeed or already has succeeded. So you need to just accept it. This is effectively what the rebel groups with Turkish help were able to do. They created this tsunami where they took over Aleppo, took over Hama, and everyone inside the regime and outside was thinking, this can't be stopped. When are they going to get to Damascus? Now, this country has been at civil war for 13 years. So you can imagine what the state of the military was. You've had a lot of defections. The economy is completely stagnant. So if you're Russia, who now is busy in a three-year war in Ukraine, which is, Ukraine is always a million times more important to Russia than Syria ever will be. Syria was an easy intervention by Russia. At most, they had 5,000 troops there, which is a small to medium-sized intervention. And Russia's actions were largely from the air. So Russian troops were not harm's way. So as far as they're concerned, we got war in Ukraine. It's been going on for 3 years. The last thing they want is they need to deploy assets to Syria after technically 9 years when they've taken back Aleppo. They've been reducing how much presence they have in the country because Bashar's won. So Russia made the decision, we got more important priorities going on. In the case of Iran, they actually were, if you've seen for the last year what's going on to Iran in the region, Hamas has been smashed, Hezbollah has been decimated, Iran's been attacked twice. Iran's got bigger issues going on. The last thing they want to do is escalate in Syria. Syria's important, but Iran's position in the region is at stake at the moment. So this is the worst possible timing for this to have happened for Russia and Iran. So that's why when it became obvious these guys aren't going to intervene, what you found was the regime soldiers didn't even put up a fight. That's why a lot of the areas fell really quickly. There was no fighting. There wasn't a fight in Aleppo. There wasn't a fight in Homs. There wasn't a fight in Hama. They put down their weapon. When they saw Russia's not coming, when they saw Iran's not coming, it was over. This is it. It's just a matter of how long did it take rebels to actually get to Damascus in the end. And that's why in the end, really, after 13 years of war, the regime just petered out. There was literally nothing there. It was hollow in the end. And as far as I've even heard, Yusuf, many regime supporters, many Alawites, many soldiers, many officers weren't even getting paid. There's literally no money to even go around to their own supporters. Also, Iran was actually building a permanent presence in this country. So for the last 3-4 years, there's actually been a lot of tension between Iran and Syria. But Bashar's view was Putin and the Iranian leadership, once they've saved me, they will go and I'll rule over the country. Iran was actually building bases and building links to stay there permanently. So this was already causing tension. So when the rebels launched their assault, it was the worst possible timing from all perspectives.
So, agreed 100%. It seemed like the regime was hollow. They didn't really have any natural support. Does HTS actually have a natural support within the country for its leadership?
So, Yusuf, you know, if you've ever been to Syria or you saw the pictures, you saw the videos, I'm sure you saw the Sadneya prison, people being in there, the pilot that refused to fire in 1982, Hama massacre, he was released. You had a guy, he was released, he went to meet his 100-year-old mother, she was still alive. There are people that still haven't been found yet. There are people who disappeared into the labyrinth of the Syrian prison system. So, you know, in that scenario, whoever overthrows the regime, you know, people are going to accept it. This regime was brutal. This regime remained for so long, Yusuf, because externally, it was a proxy for America. So the external powers backed it. Internally, it ruled with repression. It ruled with an iron fist. And when the uprising started, it was worse. I'm sure you've seen the video of the Syrian who went to Holland asylum. He went back and they found his body. I was reading actually that there were people on death row on the day the regime fell. So these prisoners fought. The officers are coming to get them, to hang them. And people came, they opened the prison entrances and they said, you're free. The regime just fallen. Literally, they thought, this is it. We're going to get hung. In that scenario, anyone who removed the regime, you're going to support them. And you mentioned in your intro that this is now is where the real test is for Ahmad al-Sharaa and his group. You now rule over a country, you've got an economy in shambles, you've got minorities who supported the regime, you've got the Kurds who still want some autonomy, you've got international isolation, which you're going to have to deal with. So I think whoever had, you know, even if Iran had overthrown the regime, the people would have supported them. If Russia had overthrown Bashar al-Assad, the people would have supported them because they just want the regime gone. The regime was brutal. So how much support they have is hard to say because they ruled in the northern areas. But anyone who overthrows the regime, the people would support them at that point.
What about Abu Muhammad Jolani, Ahmad al-Sharaa? How popular is he within the country? What's his relationship now with all the countries in the region and particularly the West? I mean, a lot of people have gone to meet him over the last couple of months.
Yes, so overnight, you know, we've learned this new concept. There's bad terrorists and there's good terrorists. That's what you have. And you can go from bad terrorists to good and good to bad. He's become the Zelensky of the Middle East. People can't get enough of him. He's changed his military attire now to tailored suits. He's meeting everybody, the Germans, the French, the British, the Americans, the regional leaders. Nobody can get enough of him. He's been to Saudi. He's done a trip to UAE. He's everywhere. I mean, anybody who thinks he's a pop star, the world can't get enough of him at the moment. So I think Ahmad Sharaa has got two challenges, really. One is just internal. He's going to have to deal with the Alawis. Some of them still support the old regime. You've got the Kurds, who they're talking to. But what the Kurds are saying is, we want some level of autonomy. You've got in the south, you've got Israel. You've got the groups over there. You've also got Shia militia in Iraq who are not happy with Bashar gone. So really, Ahmad al-Sharaa is one ruler amongst many. You know, he's saying he's a ruler of Syria. He did 30% of Syria is under Kurdish control. It's not actually under his own control. You've got the northern areas, which is really under Turkish control, although Turkey and HTS have worked together and coordinated. So yeah, he's got this pop star status at the moment, but you know, the challenges are going to start to grow. And, you know, people wanted to see change in this country. So, you know, the prisons have been opened up. There's some level of stability and security. However, you know, if you don't improve the economic situation of the people, or if he starts to compromise, I mean, the people want Islam to play some role in their country. Ahmad al-Sharaa hasn't said anything about that. In fact, he's been quite pragmatic with Islam. Considering someone who emerged from ISIS, it's actually quite surprising he's not made many Islamic statements. I mean, even Israel, he's not really said much. He said we've got to focus on internal issues for the moment. Then he did criticize Israel. Then he seemed to have done a bit of a U-turn. He obviously has got his hands full with internal issues. So external issues are, I think what his plan's going to be is he needs to show the world that, you know, I'm trying to be inclusive. I'm not like the previous regime. But he's going to want economic aid. He's going to need reconstruction help. So, you know, the image he's going to want to give is, look, we're not a Taliban, basically. We're open. Look, you know, I don't wear the clothes of Taliban. We wear tailor suits. I'm like you. So, you know, we'll have to wait and see how it works out. But, you know, his honeymoon won't last forever. If people can see that he's just the old regime in different ways, or he's pragmatic and he's not in line with the views of the people or the sentiments, then, you know, problems will probably emerge pretty quickly. The last final challenge he's having is he wants to amalgamate all the groups into the Syrian military. And the Kurds are pushing back. Mostly other groups have accepted that. Because obviously you need to take control of the arms and all that. They obviously didn't do anything when Israel bombed like 80% of their heavy weapons, you know, literally destroyed. So even the security of the country is gone, really. But that's, you know, these are the challenges Ahmad al-Sharaa has at the moment.
Yeah, I think the swap of attire was something that stood out very early on. So, yeah, they've got all these challenges, multiple different groups involved, areas which they don't have under control. They've been in power 2 months now. How have they been doing with that? Have they managed to strengthen their position?
There's too early to say here, really. I mean, there's a few key things they've done is they're meeting everybody. That's to show people that, you know, we're not a pariah. All the foreign countries are coming. But internally, they've tried to talk to the Alawis, but there's actually been some fighting between them as well. Obviously, he gave amnesty to everybody. As long as you put down your arms, if you were in the army or the security services and you register, there won't be any comeback. Similar to what the Taliban did. You know, the war's finished, we won, and now we want stability and we all got to work together. Obviously, before, the Alawis, the Bashar al-Assad family support base was their security services and the Alawis. Now the majority are in power. The Sunnis were always 70-80% of the country. They're now in power. So, you know, there's no agenda to go and fight against the Alawis and the Kurds or anything like that. What they're going to want to do is try and amalgamate them. So he's been giving out the right messages. The problem here is, you know, he's not really independent. You know, this is a guy from Camp Bakr, the ruler of Syria, which, you know, raises so many alarm bells. You know, Baghdadi we never saw, but he was the leader of ISIS. Here's the guy, he was ISIS. He was ISIS in Syria, and now he's the leader of Syria, and the West can't get enough of him.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a complicated situation. Who actually is the power behind the power? With all this in mind, with Ahmed al-Sharaa, who's the power behind him? How do you actually see the future of Syria? How do you see it playing out?
So for internally, I think, look, the security architecture has gone. So from that sense, Syria's gone from this dictatorship, secret state, to one where the relationship between the ruler and the people will be a bit more normalized. You know, you can get on with your life. You know, the regime's shown they're not like the old regime. However, we mentioned at the beginning, the importance of Syria is it shares borders with all the regional countries. And at the moment, you see that there's talks about normalization between the regional countries and Israel. And, you know, if Ahmed al-Sharaa wants money, he wants aid, then that may be a route that they go down. I mean, for Israel, it would be a massive achievement if normalization happens with Saudi, the Sunni leader, Syria, and if, you know, if these two countries join them, I mean, the only one left is really Iran. And interestingly, Iran not so long ago was the closest ally Israel had under the Shah. When the Kurds came to power, it completely changed. But what you're going to find is, apart from Iran, every other country's normalized relations with Israel. And this is probably where America sees Ahmed al-Sharaa's role. And that's going to cause tension with the people. Even Israel's being told by America to tone down their criticism of Ahmed al-Sharaa, which is quite interesting. Even they laid out against him. And, you know, they bombed the country back, God knows how far, with the attack on their military bases. Iran's gone, Russia's gone from this country. You know, you've got this leader who is not criticizing Israel at all. The feeling he's doing is, I want to talk to everybody, meet everybody. So the future externally looks as business as usual, but this time America will be quite open with their volition. But if you remember with Bashar, the image America gave was, yeah, we don't like him, he needs to reform, but we might work with him here and there. And they would even criticize him as also, you remember the axis of evil, North Korea, Iran, and Syria. That was happening. Now it's like a more of an open relationship. That's external. Internally, though, there's going to be issues. You know, if externally he goes towards the Israel normalization, that would be problems. He may do that because that will aid his image to get more economic and regional aid his way. But that was called tension with the public. And also, you know, he needs to improve the standards of people. People want jobs. People want to be able to live. They need to build infrastructure. If you can't do that, there will be problems. And what could happen is, you know, I mentioned he's one warlord amongst many. If things don't work out, he can easily be replaced. You've got the Kurds who could take over the country. You've got in the south, you've got groups linked to Israel that could take over the country. You've still got the Alawis that can take over the country. You've got Shia militias in Iraq who can take over the country. So although he's presented the image of strength, he's really one warlord amongst many. And that's why if he doesn't play ball, if he goes too much Islamic, America has other options in the country. He's one option amongst many.
Definitely a country that's very unstable, in a state of flux. Anything could happen any moment. I think it's something that we need to really follow. Thank you for your time today, Adnan. A lot to take in. I'd just like to remind the audience, check out our deep dive. It goes into more detail about this. Thank you for watching. If you want to learn about any other issues, again, check out our website, www.thegeopolitics.com. Thank you for listening. I'm Yusuf.